I'm W.S. Thackeray, and I'm interviewing Dr. R.H. Roy. It's the 6th of August, 1980.
All right, there we are, sir.
Yep. Well, first of all, you can take some notes as we go along.
Oh, I'm going to, yes.
Yeah, because I'm going to go through certain things that you might not have asked others about the early period more especially. Okay, background. Born in Glasgow, Nova Scotia, on December the 11th, 1922. It was a good year, as the saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, at that time I had no military background. Nevertheless, there was some in the family, in fact, on both sides of the family. My father had served overseas during the Great War as a sniper in the 31st Battalion, CEF. And then in 1917, I think it was, he left the Army and transferred to the Royal Flying Corps and ultimately flew bombers with the 100th Squadron Royal Flying Corps. So that there was, in other words, directly within the family, there was that connection. My mother's family, and she was a Suffolk girl. Her uncle, I believe it was in the Boer War. She had either a great-great uncle or a great-grandfather, something like that, who was in the Crimea. In fact, he was in the charge of the Light Brigade, believe it or not. So there was, to some degree, shall we say, military background in the family. Okay, now when I was about 5 or 6 years old, I moved from New Glasgow, Nova Scotia to Sydney, Nova Scotia, and there I remained for the next 10 years, at which time, when I was 16 years old, the war broke out. Now, in the spring of 1939, of all times, I joined the militia. The Cape Breton Highlanders, as it was then. They must have been desperate, because although I was only 16, I was accepted as a private. And I remember going to summer camp in Prince Edward Island in the summer of 1939. During that winter of, I suppose you call it 38-39, I think primarily because of my brother's interest, and he was with me in the unit, I took signals training and passed my signaling course, using, incidentally, the old World War I signaling equipment that we had. In other words, we had to use signaling by flag, a lot of work in Morse code, the old D3 or Don 3 field telephones, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your work was with the key, the battery operated, and the was it with the key that you transmitted over line wire to the next station and
all
Morse code and
all of it was
and this sort of thing. Yeah,
there was no wireless equipment.
No,
for the Army.
Did you use heliograph?
Slowly.
Oh. Hmm? Did you use heliograph?
Oh, heliograph. Yeah, we used the heliograph. We also used the Lucas lamp.
Oh yeah.
Which is a signaling light on a tripod. In other words, we had the best Boer War equipment than you can imagine. Or close to it. Anyway, to get on. It was obvious to me, certainly in 38-39, that war was coming. And war did break out, as you know, September the 2nd, 1939. Now, note the date there, incidentally, insofar as a young person such as myself is concerned. War broke out almost at the same time that school started.
Mm-hmm.
And I offered my services. I think this was September the 2nd. In fact, the members of the militia were ordered by radio to report to the local barracks, which consisted of three small huts, a little larger than garages, in Victoria Park. I think one hut was for the quartermaster's stores, another hut contained the offices, and I forget what was in the other hut. I think it may have been even for the local artillery, I'm not sure, but they were, you know, it was kind of grim. So we reported, I remember it was a lovely sunny day, and we went up and drew our uniforms.
May I interrupt you for a second? Was this the battalion headquarters, or in Sydney, was it a company headquarters, or what?
No, Sydney, or the Capers and Hounders, had its battalion headquarters in Sydney itself. Sydney was the big city, one of two in Nova Scotia at the time. There were other companies out in the rural areas. We didn't see them for some time. Okay, we draw our uniforms, which I remember quite well at the time. We had red and white stockings, a red flash, which tucked in your stocking. Each of us had a kilt, a sporran, a First World War tunic, First World War webbing, First World War rifle, bayonet, and bayonet scabbard. We had a Glengarry too, I think it was, and that was it. There was no such things as ordinary socks or boots or shoelaces or shirts or undershirts or sweaters or gloves or indeed almost anything. That just did not exist. We had this rather colorful but somewhat useless uniforms, and we wore that, incidentally, up until, well, I remember I was wearing it in December 1939.
A bit chilly, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did have great coats, but as you say, it was still chilly. The reason I wore it so long is because I joined up with the rank and pay of boy. They didn't take me back as private.
Oh, yeah.
They said, you're too young, you'll have to get your mother's permission or father's permission, which I did, and I was one of three boys in the unit. Now, in other battalions across Canada, there were a scattering of boys. There weren't too terribly many of us, but Walter Kenny, Ray MacDonald, and myself, we were three Sigmas. In other words, we did have some training. We couldn't have done very much because certainly there was no ammunition floating around. They accepted it. Now, one thing that I've mentioned to my class, and you've probably heard this before, was the utter and complete lack of military preparedness on the part of Canada, and certainly as reflected in our own battalion. We did have some Lewis machine guns, but we had no modern machine guns. We had no Bren gun or Tommy gun or Stirling gun or Sten gun or anything else of that nature. Absolutely none. We may have had some ammunition, but quite frankly, during our time in Sydney, which would be about a year, I cannot remember firing a single round. Not a single round. There was no anti-tank guns of any caliber. There was no boys, even a boys' anti-tank rifle. We didn't even see that. There was no 2-pounder. There was no 16-pounder, 17-pounder, anything of that nature.
They all came later, of course.
Much later.
Yeah. Tell me, if I may.
Can I go on?
Why were you there so long? You were not really on act. You were in a militia unit, which wasn't really formed of any part of a division, or actually went to any training camp.
Yeah. Well, let me
okay.
carry on a little bit more with what I was
right.
saying, though,
okay.
before, and I'll get into yours. I was talking about the lack of weaponry, which was almost absolute. In fact, we had some platoons who were training who didn't even have rifles. So that, shall we say, my platoon would train with rifles, and then we would loan these to another platoon so they would train with rifles or be able to do bayonet practice,
mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. Total, complete unpreparedness. We had no vehicles when war broke out. We didn't even have a bicycle. No bicycle, no jeep, no truck. Absolutely nothing on wheels not even a wheelbarrow. So this was not exactly a militia unit that you threw together and sent overseas. Now, the system in Canada was as follows. All across the country, there were militia units of various strengths and various degrees of efficiency. Now, where ours rated amongst all the others, I'm not sure. In the Maritimes, of course, you know, just to think of some of the others, there was the, take my own unit first, Cape Breton Highlanders, Pictou Highlanders, Prince Edward Island Highlanders, North Nova Scotia Highlanders, Halifax Rifles, and so on. Well, the method the government followed was that when the 1st Division went over in December 1939, even before war broke out, the Department of National Defense knew which of the 9 infantry units would be in that one. For example, the Seaforth Highlanders were going to be in, the Princess Patricias were going to be in, and so on. Now, the militia regiments, which would be going into the 1st Division, were given a priority in everything, in weaponry, in new uniforms, the battle dress, in trucks, in course training, all of that. So while our strength in the Cape Breton Highlanders and in many other units would remain at, shall we say, roughly about 200 of all ranks, these other units would be ordered to increase or to recruit up to what was called war establishment, which would be about 32 officers and about 750 other ranks. Until your unit, your battalion, was designated to be part of a division going overseas, or later one of the home defense divisions in Canada, until that time, your strength remained very low. Now, you're on a full-time basis, but the priorities went to those units going overseas. In fact, I can remember at one time an order coming into our battalion saying that mess tins or water bottles or something like that, we had to give up every single one we had to outfit some unit going overseas. So this sort of thing did happen. And what you had to do is just wait happily or unhappily until your time came to be one of those units.
So the strength of your unit at this time was quite low then?
Very low.
What did you say, 150 men? Or what?
No, about 200, 225, mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
And you were not actively recruiting then, in a sense? Your establishment was not very large.
There's a difference between recruiting and between recruiting to go to war establishment.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the Nova Scotian regiments was selected for the 1st Division were the West Novies, the West Nova Scotian Regiment. Now, many of the people, great many of the people, most of us actually, you joined up to go overseas. And when the West Novies were given the word to recruit to full strength, many in our unit, and indeed in the Pictou Highlanders and elsewhere, maybe 30, 40, or 50, would opt to leave our unit, transfer to the West Novies, and so get over sooner. So that if you took 40 or 50 going to the West Novies and other units of that nature, then you would recruit again up to your low strength of about 200, shall we say. So we did a certain amount of recruiting, but never up to full strength.
Mm-hmm.
We presented, I must say, though, I'm thinking of those September days in 1939. And here's another you could ask another question you could ask many of them aside from uniforms, and that is housing or barracks. We didn't have any.
You lived at home, did you?
Everybody lived at home.
Yeah.
I think you got a living out allowance of something under a dollar. Mm-hmm. Something like 75 or 85 cents, which meant that my brother and I, my brother was with me, as I say, in the Cape Breton Hundreds at this time, although he later transferred to the Royal Canadian Air Force. I mentioned to you that he was a sort of a ham operator, ham radio operator, and this is how I became interested in the signals. Well, people with his ability were very much required in the Air Force, so he transferred, maybe November, December 1939 into the RCF, and he went off to the big city of Toronto.
Number one Manning Depot, wasn't it?
Right, yeah, yeah, that was it.
I recall, yeah.
Yes, I was going to mention this bit about barracks or the lack of them. It is damn difficult for a unit to deal with a battalion, even a small battalion, whose men, shall we say, leave at 5 o'clock or 5:30 and scatter all over the place in uniform, leaving their rifles and bayonets in the quartermaster store, and then coming back at about 6:30 or 7:30 o'clock in the morning. So something had to be done about that. We, as I say, we were giving a living out allowance. It was under a dollar, I do remember that. But this was still a time when you could get a full course dinner for 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is not quite as bad as one might expect. A soldier's pay, by the way, is another item you might inquire about.
Well, boy soldier, particularly. Is
a boy soldier was 70 cents a day.
Yeah.
A private was $1.20. Lieutenant was making the gorgeous sum of about $4.50 or $5. And the colonel of a full regiment was making about $10 a day, which was a magnificent sum, as you can well imagine. We lived at home for several months, and then they took over a church. Now this church, I forget which one it was. It was on George Street in Sydney, right next to Central School, which meant that we could use the schoolyard as a drill ground periodically. You know, it was absolutely bare. The church was one from which the congregation had moved to a new and better church, so it was rented. And we lived, you know, in the choir loft, in the main hall, in the Sunday school hall, anywhere where we could bed down. Now this was, again, just our company. The other companies in the battalion were still living in the rural areas. And it was during this period, too, that they began to build, for the first time, the very familiar barracks in Victoria Park. And ultimately, it would be, I would think, in the very early spring of 1940, we moved in there. Until that time, however, it was the church in George Street. It worked. I remember our own pioneer platoon made wooden bunks, very rough, you know, just double tier bunks with a thick wire mesh, palliasses, a couple of blankets if you're lucky. And that was that.
Just two blankets, eh?
Yeah, as I remember it. Certainly no sheets or anything silly like that, but even so, you could throw your kilt over the bottom of the bed, and my God,
yeah, keep your feet warm.
That would indeed. The training we had was, as you can imagine, very basic. Drill, of course, the first thing, foot and arms drill. A great deal of button polishing, and to clean up and polish up a Highland uniform is really quite something, with all the old-fashioned brass on the, on the or the old brass on the old-fashioned webbing, and washing out your sporran, and there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pieces of brass on that that had to be kept highly polished all the time. You wore white spats, so this had to be whitened. Your shoes had to be blackened. In other words, you know, to appear shiny on parade as was demanded of us.
What do you wish, coveralls at that time?
No, not at that time. They didn't come later.
You had to work in your kilt, and your best kilt, in effect.
Your only kilt. Yeah, absolutely.
A bit hard, as you say, keeping it clean.
Oh, yeah. It was the old church used to be quite a beehive. You know, you were up in the, on the balcony of the main church, for example. That's where the pipe band played and practiced. There was always great sounds of the pipes rattling throughout the church as other people elsewhere would be trying to give a lecture, or the signalers would be trying out, signaling practice in theory. And again, all we had were these old this old equipment to practice with. We were beginning to get maybe one or two trucks at this time, but that was all. Oddly enough, we went on some route marches, but very, very few, you know, now that I look back on it. I suppose maybe because we didn't have the boots. We didn't have the proper boots or shoes to go on it with. And the colonel that we had in the beginning, Lieutenant Colonel Chisholm, was most certainly no ball of fire. He was a local man, a Sydney man. I believe he had served with our first war parent, the old 85th and 25th Battalions. But we were to go through in 39, 40, and 41, we were to go through a number of commanding officers and indeed even company commanders who were old vets, who may have been good in action, but unfortunately, they were good for another war. Hello?
Okay, we're back on.
Yeah. Now, what I said about the commanding officer and several of our majors was also true of our senior NCOs and warrant officers, our regimental sergeant major, our quartermaster sergeant, some of these sergeant majors. They, too, were First World War veterans. I remember, too, at about this time, we were loaned for a period, as I remember, one permanent force, a company sergeant major, to help clean the unit. But aside from that, the only help we got would be through the occasional issue of some of the cleaning pamphlets. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, would be British. Pamphlets on drill, pamphlets on map reading, pamphlets on administration, that sort of thing. So it was very, very much a case of quite literally lifting yourself up by your own bootstraps. But keep in mind, again, the lack of modern equipment, the lack of ammunition, the lack of just about everything. Remember, too, that this was the period of the phony war, and there wasn't the there wasn't any sense of urgency. We became very good at drill. We used to go out on physical training, of course, every morning during the winter. I can remember that quite well, running with our kilt, a balaclava hat pulled right over our face, and just a two eyes peering through the slit in the balaclava hat, and the frost forming outside the helmet as we puffed our way down towards Sydney River for a 2 or 3 mile run there and back. We were certainly getting into shape physically. Insofar as recreation is concerned, and this is something, again, you might ask the others, There is very little. We did, as I remember, get some sort of a reduction going to the movies. I don't think those who patronize, shall we say, the beer halls and all that sort of thing got any reduction in drinks.
No.
There may have been some reduction in tram fares, but frankly, I didn't use buses or tram fares. I lived about a little over a mile from Victoria Park Barracks. And of course, one used to walk. You walked everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people had a car. Very few people could afford it, even though gasoline, incidentally, would be on about, 24 cents a gallon, something of that nature.
You didn't have a bicycle as a young teenager.
No.
No.
Well, I had a bicycle, but, you know, you didn't bicycle. I don't know if you've ever tried bicycling in a kilt with a
form. It was unsoldierly.
Very unsoldierly.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, you could walk a mile in about 20 minutes. There was no sweat there. As I say, everything was very much self-help. For example, nowadays in the militia units, in their quartermaster stores, they have all the equipment for a kitchen, shall we say.
Oh, yes. Sure.
We didn't have that. We didn't have any trained cooks. It would just be somebody who maybe knew something about cooking. Or can you boil an egg? Yes, fine, you're a cook. Get cracking. Tin bowls, tin mugs, tin plates, bammo, that was it, with everybody eating in the hall. I beg your pardon, in the basement of this church where we were.
Were you getting three meals a day? You were,
oh, yes.
At that point, you were properly set up to...
Oh, yes. We were eating in regular messes. And something of the routine of Army life was beginning to appear, you know, regular reports and attendance calls and physical or medical inspections, nominal roles, etc., etc. This was something that you learn, and you learn fairly slowly. Somewhere they got some typewriters, and we established company offices in a battalion orderly room. But these were slow to come. These were very slow to come. The equipment, as I say, was pretty grim. The training was modest. Just to give you an idea, we didn't get a Bren gun, which is a modern light machine gun, until we moved to St. John's, New Brunswick. And indeed, I remember when they came in, we got about three or four of them, and they were considered to be so precious that they were kept, I think, in the adjutant's office.
What year was that? Or what month and what year?
Well, we stayed in Sydney for about a year, roughly. And as I mentioned, it was in the spring of 1940 when they were working madly away at the barracks, building enough barracks to house a battalion. And once they were built, then they brought in the other companies, where they would have somewhere to put them. These barracks were so typical, and I think are so well known, that I needn't describe them. The usual metal beds rather than the old wooden beds nowadays, the ablution rooms in the H huts, between the two long wings of the huts, which would contain the men. Some of the huts, there was one, of course, for an officer's mess, another for a sergeant's mess. Others for the quartermaster. Officers for the dentist, for the medical officer, for the quartermaster, this, that, and the other thing. You know, slowly, very slowly, we're beginning to get some order and shape. Again, this is the period of the phony war. We began to get items. How shall I put it? Items slowly would come in. So one day there would be, shall we say, an issue of sweaters or cardigans, and then maybe a week later, the word would come that the socks had been received, and then shoes would come in, and on and on like that. I was going to mention recreation. Very little of it in Sydney at that time. There was a hut for soldiers, and I forget who established it. It wasn't the Sally Iron, it may be in the Knights of Columbus or something like that. But that was the only one that I can remember mm-hmm. being established in Sydney at the time.
What about regimental sports? Did you have a good sports officer?
We did have sports? Regimental sports. We were encouraged on Saturday afternoon. No, it was Saturday morning was sort of a make and mend. Saturday was a day for scrubbing and blanking the web, polishing the web. You know, they're giving it an extra one. Sports parade, cleanup day, all that sort of thing. We did play baseball. Baseball was the main one. Some boxing, but not very much. I think, again, because of our small numbers, because the unit was kept apart and then only later thrown together, and there would be periodic drafts out of the unit, that although you had a small, comparatively small, 100-150 corps of people who had been there for some time, there was quite a changeover. And this would be, again, typical of the other units as well.
What about volleyball, which I always think of as the army game, practically? In the
I can't remember it.
Yeah.
No, I can't remember that that sort of thing at all. There was no sports area.
Oh, yes, you didn't have a...
No, the only thing at the very end of Victoria Park, there was a baseball diamond, mm-hmm. and we did use that. Now, mind you, I am not terrifically sports-minded myself. But even so, for example, there was no swimming pool. There was no swimming at all. I can't remember a swimming pool. There may be one at the YMCA. Yes, there was one at the YMCA. And now and then we would go there. But normally speaking, not too terribly much. Mm-hmm. Not too terribly much at all.
Was there any other unit in Sydney at that time?
Yep. There was the 36th Battery, Royal Canadian Artillery. And they, at first, again, were scattered around various parts of the harbor, where slowly they began to mount guns. The Navy established a naval station there and strung an anti-submarine net across the harbor mouth. Sydney became, in time, one of the great ports where convoys were collected. But that wasn't during the period when we were
no,
still in Sydney.
No,
this really came later when they built a big naval base out at Point Edward across the harbor from Sydney. So it was pretty routine, pretty simple. And then came the period, of course, when France fell in 1940. And we began to recruit more soldiers. And then we were sent off to do garrison duty in St. John, New Brunswick. So this was our first move, and that would be... I remember arriving at St. John, and we were loaded down with everything we owned. And I remember marching from the station to the barracks and slipping and sliding all over the ice, and I'm trying to remember when that would be. It would be the winter of 40-41, as I remember. It must have been. It must have been. Because I remember we were still in Sydney when France fell, and that would be May, June 1940, and it was in the winter that we went to St. John, New Brunswick. Here again, we went to a large, what had been a park, what was it called, Soldiers Green or Green Park or something of that nature. Another great mass of
of huts, a large exhibition building which was taken over as part of the mess. God, it was cold. I remember, you know, you'd get a cup of warm tea, shall we say, for breakfast or lunch in this mess hall they had in this old exhibition building, and it was so drafty that by the time you got it to the table where you're going to sit, that it'd be chilly. And of course, so would your meal and everything else. The only happy thing I think that happened there was that that damn building burned down.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a tremendous fire, and I think we lost one of our men there who was caught in it.
Oh, boy.
Almost all of our records burnt down. I was at that time with what was called headquarters company. I was company clerk. And for about a week, all company records, et cetera, et cetera, was kept in a little notepad I had. And that was that until we got, you know, reshuffled around and whatnot. But here again, this was the winter of 40-41. We had still not had a battalion exercise. One or two of our companies were out on duty around St. John's Harbor. Again, pretty routine stuff. Mm-hmm. By this time, incidentally, everybody had the battle dress. Drill had changed, of course, in 1940 from the old Form 4s, the old drill of the Great War, to the modern drill. We were being shaken out slowly in the new war establishment for the unit, which meant, well, I needn't go into detail, but instead of having a headquarters company is broken up into a battalion headquarters and a support company. Again, slowly we're getting more equipment.
I just think the fire helped that aspect out a bit.
Yeah, it did. It did a bit, but not too terribly much.
Mm-hmm. This was only a dining hall, was it? It wasn't a...
I wouldn't give it... You know, if you take the cows out of an exhibition building and sweep out the refuse, put in tables and benches,
that's it.
That is now the dining hall.
Yeah.
And, you know, the clapboard on the side of the building. No insulation, actually. It would just be, you know, sheathing between yourself and a damn cold St. John... The barracks, the actual barracks themselves, they were much better. During this time, too, more of our people were starting to go on course and learn a little bit about becoming a professional soldier. We still had a great deal of, I suppose one shouldn't call it deadwood, but I mean the older people who again, you know, even though they were World War One vets, that meant that they're only at that time in their maybe early 50s.
Or
perhaps even less.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they knew nothing, absolutely nothing about modern warfare. We had never seen a tank. We had never seen a... We had seen absolutely no modern equipment except what we saw in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. We didn't have, at that time, even modern training films. It's in 1940, of course, that the decision is made to send more divisions overseas, but it wasn't until, let's see, we went there in the winter of 40-41. It wasn't until early 41 that we were finally picked as a battalion to form part of an overseas division. Now, all around you at this time, insofar as Canada in general is concerned, you could see, especially after the fall of France, you could see a greater intensity of the war effort. You began to see more men in uniform, Navy, Army, Air Force. I remember visiting my brother in Toronto once. I was on leave, he happened to be there, and going to their, you know, number one manning depot. This was a huge establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, of course, surprised at the facilities they had there.
Well,
Okay, well, that's fine, Dr. Roy. We'll continue this on another auspicious occasion, shall we?
Right.
Thank you.
I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Dr. R.H. Roy. It's the 15th of August, 1980.
Okay, we're on. Now, we were talking, or you were talking about your living quarters in St. John's, New Brunswick in the winter of 1940-41, and how they were the bare minimum shelter that you could probably possibly imagine.
Yeah, the barracks were the same. In fact, all across Canada, barracks tended to be the same. Built of wood, naturally. No insulation that I remember. The usual one or two iron stoves in the center of the long sleeping quarters that we had.
Excuse me. I think what we were talking about was the the dining hall then. It was an old, I'm thinking of the old stable or cow barn or whatever it was that you had.
I know you are. I'm not.
No, well, I just wanted to...
no, I'll get to that.
I don't... Well, I think you discussed that, but I think we're now on to the actual barracks, the huts, I guess, that wartime built that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I don't think you did cover.
No, I didn't.
No.
And the interesting thing is, you know, being out here on at UVic campus and seeing the sort of huts that we have here, this type of hut, and this is the point I was going to make, was used right across Canada. There was sort of one army style. And you could go into the dining room, into the kitchen, into the men's quarters, into the quartermaster's stores, or what have you, of any camp right across Canada, and you'd find them pretty well the same. This wasn't necessarily so for the Navy or Air Force, but you would find it at Camp De Burt, you would find it in Gordon Head, you would find it everywhere. But just to dwell on the barracks for a moment, as I say, they were rather bare bones. If there was any insulation, I don't remember it. Plywood on the inside, sheathing on the outside. As I say, the heating was by a couple of stoves, which it would be somebody's duty to keep going all the time. In each wing of the hut, rows of double bunker beds made of metal for the most part. Latrines and ablution rooms in between the two wings of the hut.
These were H huts then?
For the most part, mm-hmm. And of course, you always got some joker. You know, there was the only doors to the place were the doors to the outside. The passageways in between were wide open. And invariably at night, you get some joker who would turn on a dripping tap on a tin basin, just going tink, tink, tink to see how many people he could get up to go to the if you go to the latrines or what have you. There was always that sort of thing.
Pretty powerful suggestion there.
These had to be scrubbed out and kept polished. Beds, blankets, etc., all made up neat and tidy so that if you tossed a quarter on the blankets, they would bounce so many inches, etc. No sheets, naturally. We weren't Air Force. And of course, everything we owned, we either carried on our back, or while in Canada, we had a small wooden box which you kept underneath your bed. And as I say, that was pretty well that. There was no place for privacy. There was parades for everything, as you can imagine. Meal parades, ordinary military parades, bath parades, medical parades, dental parades. You name it, we had a parade for it. And if we didn't have a parade for it, we'd have a bugle call for it, and so on. I should add, too, that by this time I had been elevated to the rank of private.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And instead of getting 70 cents a day, my pay went to $1.20 a day. I was a private for 6 months and then got my first stripes. and I think I got my stripes while I was in St. John, New Brunswick. So again, this was a jump in pay and all the rest of it. And shortly after that, I don't have the date, but it would be on my record, I was promoted to private. I beg your pardon, I was promoted to sergeant and put in charge of the Pioneer Platoon, whose job at that time was sort of a mini assault engineers, I suppose you'd call them nowadays, and we also had the we had to deal with any gas, chemical warfare, etc., that sort of thing that came along. Mm-hmm. So
and all of this happened while you were doing garrison duty at St.
No, jump to corporal, I believe, took place in St. John, but to sergeant would be maybe in St. John, or maybe to our next move at Camp Borden. Now, it was at St. John, New Brunswick, that I first remember seeing some of the first modern weapons that we had. I left the signal platoon at that time, but I do remember seeing the first Bren guns. Very first. The garrison duties in St. John were not terribly onerous. Certainly they didn't affect me. I was in headquarters, or as it later came to be termed, support company at the time. And not being in a rifle company, I wasn't in any of the platoons or companies that was sent out to a company position guarding this, that, or the other thing in the environs of St. John. People were fairly happy, that is to say, the men in the regiment. Our regiment had begun to grow something, a bit at this time. And we were there over the winter. And in May 1941, there was quite a ripple of excitement went through the regiment when we were informed that we were going to be part of the 5th Canadian Armored Division. We were supposed to be a motorized division. I beg your pardon, a motorized battalion in that division. Well, now, it's only when a regiment is ticked off to be part of a division that is going overseas that all the military goodies begin to come in the way of trucks, motorcycles, training equipment that you need, and being brought up to war establishment. And this took place in our first move to Ontario when we went to Connaught Ranges, where we lived under canvas, and then later when we moved from there to Camp Borden, where the 5th Canadian Armored Division was concentrating. We weren't at Connaught Ranges too terribly long. As I say, there we lived under canvas. There's the first time I remember meeting seeing our honorary colonel, the Colonel Ralston, who also happened to be the Minister of National Defense and who had been a former member of one of the battalions we perpetuated. He was either a member of the 25th or 85th battalions, both of whom the Cape Breton Highlanders perpetuated. Mm-hmm. Now, it's at both those places, starting at Connaught Ranges in Ottawa, where incidentally I did guard duty for a while, sentry go on the Houses of Parliament, quite an honor.
And you were a sergeant at this time, were you?
I'd be a corporal at this time, and certainly I was a sergeant by the... I know I was a sergeant in Camp Borden.
Okay.
Well, the move to Connaught Ranges was interesting. We were surprised to know that we were going to live under canvas, because in May in the Maritime,